Welcome to a full, unbelievably, a full after hours, meaning 2 hours. And because I am so out of practice in doing a 2-hour show, I've decided that I would invite a prominent and lively author to co-host the entire show with me. His name is Billy Lombardo. We'll talk about the reissue of one of his early and great novels and his other books, his work with Polyphony, which is a high school literary magazine that I adore, and his independent work doing other things. Billy, how are you?
I'm doing great, Rick. How are you?
Good. I did this not knowing that I was going to have Dan Nelson on, too. Dan is an old friend of mine. We are mutual friends of the great Jeff Favre, who now lives and teaches in California. And it turns out Dan has a show opening at Rhino Fest on January 26th at 7 p.m., January 26th, February 2. That'll be good because you'll be up against the Super Bowl, mm-hmm. right? That's a good one. February 9th, I don't know what's on then, and February 16th at Prop Theater. Just go to rhinofest.com. Is it a one-man play, Dan?
Yeah.
It's a one-man play. It's called Night the Cubs Won. I'm assuming this is about baseball.
It is about baseball and many other things, but mostly about baseball.
So you're sitting next to a dyed-in-the-wool White Sox fan who wrote a fantastic novel. Was it called The Man with Two Arms?
Yep.
A guy whose father took this boy and taught him to pitch with both arms. So this is something, too. What's the show about, Dan? Beside the obvious, because then it would be a really short show.
Yeah. Well, I moved to Chicago. I grew up in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and my dad was a Cardinals fan, which meant I was a Cardinals fan. I didn't really have any animosity towards the Cubs, and I moved here, and I ended up living a block away from the stadium, and I just slowly fell in love. But I always thought, my blood, is Cardinal red, and then I found out while I was here that my great-grandmother was born in Chicago, and my grandmother was born here, and her favorite team was the 1908 Cubs team. So it's about how we're all connected to baseball and how we're all connected in Chicago through the sports and what it means to have a hometown team. Specifically, it's my personal story of falling in love with the Cubs when I was supposed to be a Cardinal fan and then finding out my connection back with my family.
Interesting. It does culminate with the World Series victory. Does that have anything to do with it?
Yeah. So, the night the Cubs won is about that. And I will tell you that I was...
Don't give away too much of the show. And Billy, get involved in this anytime you want.
I just wonder if his family's going to come down and see this or not.
He actually got into a fight with me because he was a White Sox fan. We had kind of the fisticuffs in the green room.
In the green room, both looked pretty good.
Yeah.
No punches
not
landed.
Not too many punches.
No punches landed.
My wife and I went to Enoch's restaurant. Do you remember Enoch, Bin 36?
I do indeed, sure.
Yeah, he was on the show, and he's just such a great host, and people from all over the world were there, and we were watching it. And
that's where you watched the game?
That's where I watched the game.
Interesting.
And I'm telling you, it couldn't have been a better place. And then when they had the rain delay, my wife's like, I can't take the pressure anymore. I'm going to go home.
That was ridiculous.
And she said, but just take a cab home afterwards, right? And I said, no problem. Sure, I'll do that.
Why were you drinking?
I was drinking a lot. And Enoch, the wine.
That literally had to be one of the great. It had to almost rival St. Patrick's Day for the amount of booze consumed on that night. Where were you, Billy?
I was at Division 4, D4 restaurant on
over here?
Yeah, it's right around here.
It's an Irish bar?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What were you doing
there?
I was
dating an actor, and we were there with a bunch of the people from her group, and there was a couple of people there were just like, they just couldn't contain themselves. And there was this one woman, I just remember her, she just walked out, she put her jacket on, she said, I'm going. And then we saw her about 10 minutes later just walking up and down the street. she just couldn't handle it.
What was it like in Enoch's place at Bin 37? What was it like
there? It was crazy because, there was
Was it jammed?
It was, yeah, there was no elbow room. And, he's from Africa,
right,
for those that don't know, and he told me many times how stupid baseball was, and I was a soccer fan, and by the end, he was standing behind me, like, sweating every pitch, but when the game was over, I told my wife I'd take a cab home. I got on the red line, And I was with my sister, who's not from here, doesn't know her way around.
So you lied to your wife. You said you'd take the cab and you got on the red line.
We were drinking. Things happen. And
you forget your promises.
Yeah, well, you know.
Did I say train?
And so
tram?
My sister calls my wife and says, listen, he says we're getting off at the Addison stop and we're going to walk into this Meru. And she says, put him on the phone. She puts him on the phone. She says, promise me you won't do that. I said, okay, I won't do it. And then the doors opened at Addison. So a lot of the play is about what happened that night. And I will tell you, the wheels came off.
What time did you get home?
I think it was like 5:30, 6 o'clock. So that the last time my wife had heard from me, she thought I was going to be home in like 15 minutes.
Ooh, I know your wife, Michelle. She's a lovely, wonderful person. You got to tell us, you are still married.
We are still married, but I will tell you that it took a toll.
So basically the play surrounds your familial connection to the Cubs,
yeah.
Your familial connection to the St. Louis Cardinals, your falling in love with the Cubs. Can I go that far?
Absolutely, yeah. And by the way, Michelle and I, you know, we fell in love going to Cubs games. We used to go to Taco and Burrito Palace, get two burritos, go in the stadium. And if you went in the bleachers back then, they had these big cement blocks. Now they have plants on top of them. And we would go up there, and you'd have this whole, like, 5x5 block you could sit on. We have a picnic, Mexican picnic, and we watched the games. And we did it every time we went. It was so great.
I want to talk not just about your show, but about literature's fascination with baseball, mm-hmm. because many writers, Billy Lombardo mm-hmm. included, have been drawn to that game, and I want to know why. Much more so, I think, than football. Much more so than certainly golf. We mm-hmm. got to take a break, but we will carry on with Dan Nelson, whose show will run Sundays beginning January 26th at the Intimate Prop Theater at 3502 North Elston. Go to rhinofest.com and look for Night the Cubs Won. Go to BillyLombardoAuthor.com. You will hear so much more from Billy because he is co-hosting this show tonight, and we will be right back. Welcome back. This entire show is devoted sort of to my friend and the great author Billy Lombardo, who will be co-hosting this thing. We are now talking, the Billy and Rick show, to Dan Nelson, who's a one-man show, The Night the Cubs Won, premieres January 26th at 7 o'clock and runs Sundays, February 2nd, 9th, 16th at Prop Theater. You can go to RhinoFest, RhinoFest.com to get tickets. This is not the first time you've done a show for RhinoFest, have you?
Right. This is the third year in a row they've asked me to perform there.
Really?
Yeah.
You must be a great performer. I reviewed you, Dan, in 1996, a quarter of a century ago, almost. You were young, still sort of young, and obviously talented writer-performer who opened his one-man show, Caps, at the Stage Left Theater. Much of the material is familiar. It's a sort of joy-of-the-game chatter about baseball that peppers, less articulately and inventively, conversations between all fans. Though a piece in which Ryan Sandberg tears the head off a pigeon is downright surreal. Do you remember that piece?
Oh, yeah.
Why did Ryan Sandberg tear a head off a chicken? Pigeon.
So this sort of really happened. It wasn't Ryan Sandberg, but I was with an Irish friend who had never seen a pigeon in real life. He'd only eaten it at restaurants. And it was...
Welcome. Come to Chicago. See all the pigeons.
And he was like, oh my God, this poor pigeon's got a broken wing. And I said, oh yeah, you should step on it, which he didn't think was as funny as I did. And he goes, well, we need to take care of it. And he took it to the police station by Wrigley Field. And, you know, they went nuts and threw him out. And then he came out and he was holding this pigeon. And some guy came by and he said, you know, what's up? And he goes, this pigeon's got a broken arm. And he goes, well, let me take care of it. And he literally just ripped his head off. He goes, it's fine now.
Oh, my God.
Right in front of us.
So you put Ryan Sandberg in that.
I made it be Ryan Sandberg because the guy, the experience was so surreal. Mm-hmm. And Ryan Sandberg to us was sort of this holy figure back then.
Did you ever see that video of, I'm blank on his name now, the tall, lanky pitcher and he hit a pigeon. He's threw a pitch and he, mm-hmm. Randy Johnson.
Randy Johnson.
Yeah.
Did he kill it?
Well, of course, Randy just exploded. It's an amazing video. It's exploded right in front of the batter. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was an incredible thing.
How often have you performed, Dan? I know what you and Michelle do for a living.
Yeah. So Michelle and I, she rehabs houses, and I'm a real estate agent. So,
yeah.
So there's that, which really connects you back to Chicago too, as well.
No question.
Just,
yeah.
You just can't be when you're.
What's building. The hot neighborhood now?
Well, Andersonville is, you know, really strong. I mean, if you can get in there, it's so difficult. But it's there's so many beautiful houses there that you can mm-hmm. still, like, fix up and stuff. It's a beautiful place. So
what about your performing career, though?
Yeah,
I mean, you have to perform a bit as a real estate agent.
Yeah,
I
so I stopped for about 15 years, not because I didn't like to do it anymore, but because nobody really wants to see theater anymore. And the challenge is always to get them to see original work was, like, trying to get them to come. And that part was just so exhausting to me. So I got away from it. And I did a moth story once and
sure.
won that. And I went to some moth competition. And it just kind of got me excited again. So I did a show, just one show that I wrote about the last job that I was at, and did it in the basement of my house and invited 50 people. And I was like, I really miss this. So then the next year, Rhino Fest asked me to be in one of their shows. So then,
why did they ask you? Because someone from Rhino Fest had
There was some connection from the past, and they said, hey, you know, they I wouldn't say so much they asked me as they said, if you fill out this form, we'll consider you.
Yeah, that's not so exactly begging.
It's not exactly asking. But then after that, they asked me. And so that went pretty well. And then last year, I did a story about my poker career. And so then they asked me to do this one this year.
And I read somewhere that you started playing poker with your paper route money.
That's right.
And what was the paper? What was the newspaper?
It was the Fort Wayne News Sentinel. It was an afternoon paper.
Guessing
the morning
it's not
paper
around
was a Journal
anymore.
Gazette. I didn't want to get up in the morning, so
the
I did
good
the
old days.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah. So all my friends that had paper routes, we all played poker, and we played like for all of our money, like there were $200 in the pot. And finally, one of our parents found out and banned us from playing anymore.
Well, it's a great thing because Billy, you use a lot of your memories of Bridgeport and childhood in your work. I mean, a lot of them, and people you have known. You too, Dan. I mean, I think that most writers, unless you're, you know, Stephen King, maybe, who's probably run out of all of his childhood characters about 18 books ago, that's the source. That's the mine, isn't it?
Yeah. Flannery O'Connor said that once, if you made it through childhood, you should never have any problem coming up with material for stories.
How hard was it to write this show, Dan?
I never think that it's hard. What's hard is making it good, you know, so that the idea is there and you're just always working on it and working on it. You know, Billy asked me in the green room when we were fighting, you know, how long I've been working on it.
During your brawl.
Yeah, and I said, you know, really, when I did the last show, it was such a good experience. I immediately thought of this, so I've been working on it ever since. So it's more about trying to figure out what fits and what doesn't. I mean, the idea is about 4 hours long, and I end up doing about a 50-minute show. So it's about what really works together and what's the story. Because while the story of the Cubs winning is a great story, I'm always trying to weave in the fabric of real life and the connection back, you know. If baseball is great to baseball fans, and if you want to talk about someone legging out a triple, I can talk about that all day, but we don't care about baseball because of that. We care about it because the connection back to our family and friends. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's really a meaningless win if you don't have someone to celebrate with and you can't connect back to something bigger than that. So,
Billy, you think that's true, too? I mean, that's an interesting observation. I mean, do you think that's what draws a lot of writers, Bernard Malamud to, you know, to David Halberstam to baseball because it so lends itself to metaphor?
You know, I'm not, I feel like the game itself, just watching, there's something about the game, just watching the game, and it's one of the things that a lot of people just don't like about it is they just feel it's too slow. But it's one of those things. I remember being at a game with my son once, And it was the first time I had noticed, just as the pitcher went into his windup, that everyone else on the field just had this little, this beautiful little shifting, crouching moment. Everyone on the field at the exact same time. And it was so hard after that to not look for it. And it's just, I don't know, it's just that. So it's some of the things that you see that are beautiful like that. But then so much of my love for it is being the father of a couple of kids who play baseball too, and having all those, you know, dads around who are, you know, betting on some of the games. I remember being at a game in Melrose Park, and a guy looked at me and he said, it was a rookie baseball, it was the first year of kid pitch baseball, and he looked at me and he said, I got a half a Hondo on this game.
And you said, which team?
Yeah, so it's just team? All these characters, too.
Well, and it's also that there's that timeless nature to it, too. I mean, a baseball game could feasibly go on.
Yeah, yeah. There's no clock.
Forever.
No clock. You don't know when it's going to end. You know, if you watch a college basketball game, it's pretty much going to be 2.5 hours.
Yep.
But a baseball game, you know, if you get two guys that work fast, two pitchers that work fast, it could be a 2-hour game, you know.
How often do you guys go to games?
I'd probably go to, you know, when the Sox were, when Ozzy was here, they had that Ozzy plan, and you get like 13 games or whatever, and that's when my son was going to games, and so I don't go to as many games now, but I always have this dream of having season tickets and going to games all the time.
Dan, it's a different experience going to Wrigley now, now that the, when I used to go there, walk there from Old Town, they open the gates after the sixth inning, and everybody just get in,
right?
Go to the game.
And you could walk down to the third row. Nobody really paid attention.
No one would, you can't move it.
It's really, it is vastly changed. The neighborhood has changed. Yeah. Has the baseball game experience changed for you?
Yeah, it has for me. You know, I try not to say it was better in my day, because when I was there, and then, you know, we had season tickets for 12 years.
Wow.
And we sat two rows in front of Harry Carey, and it was the most incredible seats. My wife got called, you know, we were on a list or something like that, and got called to go look at the tickets. It was like the worst seats in the house, and she said, no, I don't think I want this. And then literally with some electronic device before anyone knew how to use them, and this woman who probably got paid $8 an hour goes, some other tickets came up, and somebody had just turned in their tickets that minute, and we walked over and got them. So, I mean, they were just such great seats. And they were $24 a seat, which I thought was so expensive.
Yeah.
But then when they got up to $100, for me, that it just wasn't.
Well, for many people, it is, unless you run a corporation. We're going to continue on with Dan Nelson, whose show the night the Cubs won will be at the part of Rhino Fest at the Prop Theater, January 26th, February 2nd, 9th, and 16th. Perfect thing to go see Dan's show and then listen to this show. It's a perfect evening of Chicago. Billy Lombardo, who will be on co-hosting with me this entire show. His latest book is a reissue of How to Hold a Woman. It is A Morning Will Come. We'll talk at length about that. We got to take a little break now, and we'll be back with these guys momentarily. Welcome back. We got a few more minutes with Dan Nelson, whose show, Night the Cubs Won, premieres Sunday, January 26th, and runs the next three Sundays, February 2, 9, and 16 at Prop Theater, legendary theatrical space at 3502 North Elston Avenue. Go to rhinofest.com for information and tickets. You self-direct, Dan Nelson?
Yeah, yeah.
See, because
I have a technical person that works with me named Miles Sennett. And so we work together a little bit. By the time I come to him, it's pretty much put together, but I get his feedback at that point.
Billy, when you write, when you have written short stories and nonfiction and wonderful novels, who edit? Do you collaborate with an editor? I know that a publisher traditionally, you know, would give you, in the old days, would say, this man here is Maxwell Perkins, meet Billy Lombardo, you know. How does that work these days for you?
Yeah, I was really dependent on that sort of thing in the early days.
I'll bet.
I have a couple readers now, a couple friends who are good readers, and really effective at helping me figure out those things that are missing. I really have gotten pretty good at figuring out what's missing,
yeah.
and what's working, what's not working. The shorter form, though, it's just a lot easier for me. In the longer form, I mean, just novels still are a bear to me. They're
yeah,
a beast,
bet.
And I can't.
I'll bet.
I can't. I'm interested in talking to these other guys who we're going to talk to today, too, because that's just I just don't quite understand.
Well, good. That's how you can yeah. be co-hosts and ask them questions,
right.
and I'll go have a cup of coffee or something. No, I
part of it is I grew up in a house without books
with no
for
books,
the most
I know in Bridgeport
part, yeah.
with no books
yeah.
there's no basis
right and I could it was I can't I don't know the structure of the novel all that much and for
but
some
you've
reason
taught, you've taught you,
yeah.
you've taught for
mm-hmm.
most of your adult life
right
how has that helped? I mean, I want to talk to our next guest is a guy, a novelist named Jay Amber, who spent most of his career
right.
as a teacher, too. And I'm interested in how that affects the life
yeah.
of a writer. So do you read this, Dan Nelson? Do you read your show in front of your wife, Michelle?
No, she will see it for the first time the night of the show, and she is in it quite a bit.
Well, I bet. It's like, honey, come home. Where are you? Honey, come home.
Well, a lot of it is the story of three women that intersect in my life. My mom, Michelle, my wife, and my great-grandmother, who came from Ireland here and became a baseball fan.
Doesn't it sound good?
Yeah.
Billy,
yeah.
It sounds really good. You get nervous before you go on now?
When January 1st came and I realized I was performing 26, I started to get sick. And I have been, every morning I wake up and I think, why did I do this? Why am I?
Yeah, are you in costume?
No, I mean,
are there any props?
Believe it or not, I wear a suit.
Is there a you do?
Yeah,
I don't think I've ever seen you in a
well,
suit. I mean, that may be worth.
I'll at least send you a picture.
Is there a set?
No, it's just a black box. It, you know, especially for the festival, it makes
right.
more sense. Oh, I don't know why I forgot this. There's a screen aside me the whole time, so that there are pictures that go along with my tale that kind of, when I flash back in time, you can see it.
Is there a picture of your grandmother?
There is a picture, yeah.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. And you're working the
no,
photos?
Miles does.
Yeah.
No,
he has
to do a lot, actually.
I want to think that your family is able to rise above your sort of traitorship.
Being a traitor, yeah.
And,
you're turning your back on them.
Right, and we'll fill the house with their bodies.
So I don't have any family here. They are in the Midwest, but they're in Indiana.
And they have cars, right?
In Kansas and Missouri. So I don't think that they're going to make it. to hear about me loving the Cubs.
Yeah.
Why four performances? I mean, usually Rhino Fest, I mean, you have to have been around for a while to get that kind of run.
So, Rick, just to be clear, my last show, I only signed up for one performance. And
this is the one that they begged you to do,
yeah,
right? Yeah, yeah.
Begged me.
Uh-huh.
And then they asked me to do 12 afterwards. But I didn't. I only did the one.
Did they really?
Yeah.
That's great.
And then this year, they, you know, I had a lot. I had other opportunities, but I just want to do the show and then move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
It's hard to explain because when I was younger, this would have been a dream.
You know? Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, Jeff Favre, with whom you've collaborated on
yeah.
a number of creative ventures, will he be flying in to see this from
no.
Hollywood?
He will not, but...
You'll tape it?
I'll tape it for him.
Okay.
And,
okay.
you know that Jeff is the best storyteller in the world.
He's great. He is great.
And a lot of what I do, I got from
inspired
watching
him. Inspired from him.
To, yeah, for sure.
Dan, best of luck with this thing. It sounds great. And love to your wife, your long-suffering or suffering during the World Series wife, Michelle. Go to rhinofest.com to get tickets. It's Sunday, January 26, Sunday, February 2, February 9, and February 16 at Prop Theater.
Thanks, Rick.
Dan, good to meet
you're
you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, nice to meet you, Billy.
You can stick around while I grill Billy on...
yeah.
Billy, let me ask you, the reissue of How to Hold a Woman, which was a novel that was very well received, and I was thrilled to see it's coming out again in a in a title that's a relative reminiscent of Nelson Algren.
Right.
Nelson Algren's Never Come Morning, Morning Will Come. The cover of this thing is beautiful.
Right, it's really
just beautiful.
Nice.
And it's published by the Jerry Brennan at Tortoise Books, mm-hmm. who I had on a month ago.
Yeah, he says hi, by the way.
And I say hi to him. I think what he's doing is he's a very selective kind of publisher.
Yeah.
How did that happen? Who said, maybe Rhino Fisk begged you to reissue your novel. How did it happen?
You know, I had I was with another publisher before, and I just didn't get I just wasn't happy with it. I felt like it was Zank Press, and I think and it was picked up at first by other voices.
2009.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't getting statements and that kind of thing, and I just felt this is my best book at that time. I feel like my books show my development as a writer, and I was just really happy with the stories in this one. I just felt like it didn't get into enough hands, and I got out of the contract. And then my girlfriend Amy Danzer, who you've met, she's done a lot of panels and stuff at the Printer's Row.
Well,
she works at Northwestern.
She's a real force on the Chicago literary scene.
She really
a very energetic force on the Chicago literary scene.
Yeah, and she knows Jerry Brennan, knew him better than I did, and said, "Why don't you just give it to Jerry? I mean, see what he thinks about it." And within a month, he said he'd take it. I was just tickled pink
about
it. Yeah.
That's great. Mm-hmm. That's great, because it is. You didn't seem to, I mean, I remember reading the first one,
mm-hmm.
Whatever it was called, because now it's called Morning Will Come.
Yeah,
How to Love a Woman. God, I can't tell you how cool. What do you think of this cover, Dan?
It's a great cover, but also I like how few pages it looks like that book is.
Right.
Absolutely perfect.
It could be a one-man show.
Absolutely.
It could be a one-man show on stage.
No.
There's a beautiful foreword mm-hmm. by the aforementioned Gina Frangella in there, in which she says, among many things, she says this. I want you both to comment on this. She says, writers can be a prickly species, perhaps due to the constantly dueling forces of demoralizing rejection from a publishing industry that is itself imperiled versus the almost unfathomable ego it requires to believe that a writer has something urgent and crucial to say that somehow justifies the seemingly masochistic pursuit of novel writing. That's a wonderful, wonderful sentence.
Yeah.
Is it true?
Yeah, I think so. I also think that, you know, when you're writing, you're constantly telling yourself that what you write is trash. And so it makes you sort of, when you're in that process, embittered, and anyone that kind of hits that circle feels that. But that's how you get to make it better, is by challenging yourself all the time.
Yeah,
absolutely. What do you think, Billy?
I feel like the joy for me, and there I can recall a couple of instances in my life where I felt like I just nailed this. Just said exactly the thing that I wanted to say, and that has driven me through this whole process, and that is really the great joy of it. It's also, like you, Dan, I suspect, it's about having an audience too. I love that. You just mm-hmm. you can't see the
see,
people
Bill,
who are reading your book.
You've done a lot of performing. I think in many ways our mutual friend and the guy I admire beyond words, Mark Smith,
right,
and his poetry slam at the Green Mill. That was one of the things that really helped inspire you,
mm-hmm.
getting up and reading your own work,
right,
as intimidating as it can be.
Right.
How did that inspire
Absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. We had a reading last night, the Tiger Room Salon with Sin Salach and Chris Green.
Sin's a great poet.
And Mark was there. He's had incredible influence on me, but it was that stage. I went a number of times before I did anything, and that stage was there every Sunday night, and it got me to write. And at the time, people are smoking and drinking in bars and chatting and not really ready for listening to poetry at the Green Mill. And so if you wanted people to listen, you had to shut the place down. You had to do something that worked.
Well, in this, you know, the thing is, both of you, in this increasingly icy world in which we live, where, you know, the responses you get to life are based on tweets and mm-hmm. and other things, to have an audience of human right. beings respond in any
yeah.
fashion, I think, is empowering. Yeah.
I love that. It's really, and you can't see it. I love when I hear from people, especially complete strangers, who say, I think you nailed this. I had a brother who died, and no one has nailed that kind of grief the way that you have. You know, a blind woman I got an email from once who said, you have to get this on audio tape. These stories that are just great to hear. But it's really nice when you're on stage and you see that this thing just landed on a bunch of people, you know.
Yeah. yeah.
Even if none of them are family members.
Yeah, right? No, it's all the better, actually.
You have to alienate your family before you can be a successful stage actor. We're going to take a little break. We're going to get Jay Amberg on the phone. And Dan, if you want to stay and I mean, I find this really interesting, having creative people talk about this. He's a novelist who came to it rather late after a career in teaching, and he's good. He's good. So we'll take a break. And the great producer, Ro Coleman, will get Jay Amberg on the phone and tell him he's going to join a conversation. Welcome back to the show. As you know, the show is being co-hosted this evening by Billy Lombardo, the author and a force on the local literary scene, too, in addition to make a very potent pair, he and his girlfriend, Amy Dancer, and Dan Nelson, whose show, one-man show, Night the Cubs Won, will be at Rhino Fest January 26th, February 2, 9, and 16. Our new guests, and I asked them both to stay because I'm very interested in having Billy especially talk to Jay. Jay Amberg, hi Jay, how are you?
Good, how are you, Rick?
I'm good. We met some years ago when you published, it's a collection, it was called 52 Poems for Men, which I really loved, and subsequently you've written, you know, a dozen novels, haven't you?
A dozen books, six of them are mystery thrillers.
Like, those are novels, though. That's what I think.
The other ones have exciting names like the Creative Writing Handbook and the Study Skills Handbook and that sort of thing.
Well, but I like that, and that's why I'm keeping Billy on, too, because Billy was a teacher for many years, and you were a teacher for many years, and I'm interested from both of you. What did teaching give you two gentlemen as writers? Did it give you tools? Did it enlighten you talking to younger people who were in your class? Jay, you taught at Glenbrook South, and Billy taught at Latin and other places. What did it do for you, Jay?
I think what it did for me was enable me to learn to listen to students and to listen to their stories. And though none of the stories I write are anything like the stories that the students told me, there was an ability they had to get across the passion they felt, that sort of thing. I taught a lot of writing classes, and I think, as I said, it was more the listening than the teaching that did it. And all of that came into my mind. I mean, obviously, there were instructional things that I could teach them, but I always felt I learned as much or more from them as they learned from me.
How interesting. Billy, what do you think about
that? Yeah, Jay, you worked with Bob Boone, too, on a couple of those books, didn't you, or one of them?
Yeah, I had worked with Bob Boone on something called the SAT Verbal Review and Workbook way, way back.
Yeah, a far cry from the healer's daughter, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. but, you know, it sold well.
Yeah.
And Bob's inspired, you know, a couple of generations of writers in this town, too. How did you hook up with him, Jay? How did you know him?
When I first started teaching, I was doing student teaching down at 65th and Wood, and the teacher who was working with me, Jerry Grunska, invited his buddy Bob Boone just to stop by one of the times and watch and then talk with me. And Bob and I have been friends ever since. That was the summer of 1971.
Wow. And Bob then went on. Wow. There would be no Young Chicago Authors without right. Bob. There would be no Young Chicago Authors, right. period, yeah. without Bob Boone. That's great. Did he inspire your work? I mean, let's take The Healer's Daughter, for instance. Do you feel Bob Boone in your words? Do you feel anything, any influence at all?
Again, I think Bob influenced me much more in my attitudes towards students, yeah. in my work with students, and then that work inspired some of the other writing. But again, we worked together early on writing. He and I worked for a magazine called Writing.
Sure, I remember that magazine, yeah.
And the deadlines there, the kind of constant stress and pressure, it wasn't bad stress, it was actually quite a bit of fun, but we spent 3 or 4 years doing articles for Writing Magazine and another magazine called Current Media. Mm. And it was my working with him there that really helped me get started with writing as well.
Yeah.
How did you make the leap, J. Amberg, into fiction? And it just, to me, I've yet to make it. I have a bunch of, you know, pieces of novels stuck in my desk at work, but have never been able to make that leap. How do you make that leap to becoming a fiction writer?
I think for me it was the question, what if? The nonfiction writing I've done, there was always a plan, and there was always, explain this. It was more expository. Whereas with the fiction, it was, what if something like this happened? What if the most famous basketball player in the world's daughter is kidnapped? What would happen? And so it's much more exploratory than the nonfiction writing was.
Was it difficult for you?
The switch?
No, the writing of fiction, sitting down in front of a computer or a piece of paper and answering those questions that you had.
There's an old line about all you do is sit there and wait to sweat blood under the desk.
Yeah.
But the truth of the matter is that for me, it's very energizing to have these characters come alive,
right.
Particularly characters that are not especially like my family and friends, people I know, and they become very real to me. And I know that sounds a little crazy, by the way, but they do.
I don't think it sounds crazy at all. Billy, it sounds crazy to you.
No, Jay, I have a question. So, this novel of yours, The Healer's Daughter, takes place in Turkey. Does it take place in Turkey?
Yes.
Right. So you had to do a lot of research for this, and I
think it's an intensively, tell me I'm wrong, Jay, but this is a very, very an intensively researched book. There's a lot of history in here. There's a lot of facts in here, which I like to make it a kind of a historically sound story. Yeah?
Yeah. That came about in a fairly mundane way, though. A few years ago, another colleague of both Bob's and mine got an email about working in Turkey, teaching teachers to teach English. Many of the students in Turkey, most of the students in private schools, at least in the western part of Turkey, need to learn English. Mm-hmm. It's part of the curriculum. And so for a year, I split the job with Mark Larson, who I said is a friend and colleague of both Bob's and mine.
Mark Larson of Evanston High School, who just...
No,
not
no,
a different
no, that's
Mark
the
Larson.
Irony. There are two Mark Larsons. They both write books. They both taught high school.
Yes, it's not an uncommon name, yeah.
But Mark Larson taught at Highland Park High School.
Okay, they're all the suburbs are filled with Mark Larson's teachings.
Yeah, exactly. Mark Larson's teaching English.
We got to get back to that question, Jay. We got to take a break and then I think get some news. But if you can stay on the line, I'm glad you could join. Dan hasn't said anything yet, but I know he has questions too. But you and Billy, there are a lot of similarities here with this teaching thing, and I find it fascinating. We'll be back. Welcome back. I'm sitting here with my, no, it's a three-host show, Dan Nelson, whose show will be part of Rhino Fest, Billy Lombardo, whose book should be part of your bookshelf, and on the phone, Jay Amberg, whose latest, we've been talking with Jay about teaching and about literature and life in general, whose latest is The Healer's Daughter. You can learn all about Jay. He's got a nice website at jayamberg.com. Jay, The Healer's Daughter was your latest, was inspired by your time in Turkey. Did you sense, was it the exotica of the place? Was it the people of the place? Is there a direct seed for your inspiration for this book?
Yeah, in fact, there was. When I went to Turkey, I was commuting between Chicago and Izmir, which is a city on the Aegean, and 6 weeks on, 6 weeks off. And the place itself, that Aegean area of Turkey, just kept speaking to me more and more. And one of the towns I visited, Bergama, was built upon the ruins of a city, Pergamon, that had been the cultural rival of Athens 2,500 years ago.
Wow.
And there was quite a story about the art and a number of the treasures from Pergamon that disappeared. And so the what if that I was thinking about there happened to be, what if these treasures still exist? And so that was the germ that got things going.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, go ahead.
You go.
So I was thinking about when you mentioned that, the Stephen King's book on writing, which is one of my favorite books on writing, where he speaks about that too, that each of these books are like, they start with this question, you know, what if this happened? What if a family was trapped in a car and there's a, you know, Cujo right outside and that sort of thing. As you're writing these books, now I know that they've got three women who joined forces against corrupt officials and terrorists and oligarchs and all that sort of thing. Is that something that was inspired by people that you met there?
In part, yes. I was working with a private school that had a primary and secondary faculty, and the women that I worked with, it was mostly women, it wasn't entirely women, were just such bright, good, honest people mm-hmm. that I began thinking about, again, what if this sort of person knew something or came across something that other people would want to maybe get rid of her. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned earlier, this is my sixth mystery thriller. And in the first five, the main character is a white American male who eventually figures things out. And what I did with this one was just get rid of him completely.
Yeah.
And so I think the story was served quite a bit by my subtracting that white American male out of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
And these very strong women land up doing some things that are courageous and also necessary.
Right. Mm.
Jay, before I let you go, and Billy, you can answer this too, how do you find, in since you started writing fiction, how do you find the publishing business these days? I mean, it is certainly different than it was 30 years ago, as you know. Is it difficult to get a book noticed, to get a book reviewed in a substantial way?
I think it is harder. I lucked out very much with my first book in that it was picked up without my having an agent and published by Warner Books, again, about 30 years ago. But I had a New York agent for a long time who helped me navigate all that. But the explosion of social media and the use of social media to publicize books has pretty much changed everything.
Right.
And so I really find it a much more complicated and messy world than it once was, at least for me.
And I think one of the things that I'm really happy about is that it's just the growth of these indie publishers like Tortoise, you know, Books, who can just, it just gets these books into more hands. And none of my books have been agented, so I feel like it's been harder to get an agent than anything.
Well, agents can sometimes be idiots, and they don't really know what's going on. I know Dan Nelson doesn't have an agent for his theatrical stuff, do you?
No, definitely not.
Jay, I greatly admired The Healer's Daughter, and I greatly admired you for fighting the good fight in this whole thing. You can read more about, and there are a lot of nice things. My old friend Diane Donovan said that this is a book that keeps readers on their toes with its powerful blend of Turkish cultural explorations, international intrigue, a treasure hunt, historical references, and characters who hold their own special interests close to their heart. The Healer's Daughter is an exceptional thriller that proves hard to put down. That's pretty good, Jay. Yep. You can learn more about Jay at jayamberg.com. Stay warm this winter, and let me know when the next book's out, Jay.
All right. Thank you. Nice meeting you.
Always nice. I'm glad you got to meet Billy and Dan, too. Take care. Interesting guy, but he's saying the same thing. Talk to me about Tortoise Books some more. I mean, I had them on, they explained it, but perhaps someone wasn't listening that night.
Right. I mean, one of the things I really like about Jerry Brennan at Tortoise is that he's so committed to his work. You know, he's my first statement I got from him was, I think it was for 91 cents or something like that, because the book is not out yet, and they gave a laugh, but I was like kind of happy that someone was on top of it like that.
And, paying that close attention.
And I was like, I think that there'll be some bigger checks after that, and I said, why don't you just roll that over into the next one, because I think the next one's going to be huge.
One of the things that distinguishes them, too, is their sort of artful way with print and covers.
Right.
I mean, they are very aesthetically conscious.
Yeah.
Because this book is, should put Dan Nelson somewhere, an amazing cover.
It is really a stunning cover.
It is about loss and love, to put a big umbrella over this. Mm-hmm. Isn't that right, Billy?
Yeah, absolutely. And it started off with some stories that there were a number of people who told me stories that I made a part of it. And probably five different people told me stories, and the trick of it was, and I think that's kind of what you were talking about too, Dan, when you're talking about the trick of doing it right and figuring out how do you get in this piece and how do you get in this piece, and it starts off, you know, maybe 50 pages longer than it ends up, and what goes and what stays, and the trick of this was getting rid of some characters so that they all these stories sort of fit together.
Well, Gina Frangella, who's a very talented writer, writes a lovely, lovely foreword to this book. It talks about when she first tried to convince you to do this book for her. She had a publishing house at the time. And she writes here that you delivered the book in, like, 2 weeks or something.
Right. So she gave me, she went through the whole book. She was sick as a dog when we met. She's just an amazing editor. She's like an old school editor. And she just told me so many things that would fix it. And I was like, holy cow. And she's like, well, let's see what he does now with it. And she had the experience of working with some writers who are just like, well, what the hell is she talking about? she the writer or am I the writer? But there's so many things that she told me to do that I just did. And she's got this big picture stuff that I don't. And she's like, I just don't think about plot all that much. And she's like, well, what about this? And what about this? And it can't start off this way. It's got to start off at a little higher if it's going to go anywhere after that. And I just made these, I was just so excited about the possibility of publishing it with her that I made these changes within 2 weeks. And she thought she wasn't going to see me for another year or so. But she was, you know, I read that. I was coming home from Wisconsin with Amy, and I read the, I got the introduction, the foreword from Gina on
it's
my
really,
email.
I mean, it's really
it's unbelievable.
Beautiful. And I, Dan, you can read it during the commercial. Yeah, it's started, really, really, you start
I started crying, three
Did
times
you?
While I was talking to Amy and when I was reading it to her in the car.
And Amy is thinking, well, maybe I should get a new boyfriend.
This guy's a baby. He's from Bridgeport?
Hey, this kid can't be from Bridgeport. He's a baby. Why is he crying at a foreword to a book? But what do you think? Your other books, would you think to steal them back from their publishers and have them all done by Tortoise, or is that too
Yeah, I love, I feel like The Man with Two Arms is the novel I sort of learned how to write on. So
yeah,
that's the one that's a little, it's a little more difficult for me to pick up. And I remember when I was editing it for the last time, there was some, I mean, I wrote it over 9 years, and some of the paragraphs you read, they're like paragraphs that I wrote when I was, you know, 9 years younger. And I'd be like, oh, you poor bugger, you didn't know what you were doing, you know. And then I'd read another paragraph and I'd be like, hey, that one's not bad, that's more recent Billy. That was Overlook Press, and it was just, it was not edited closely, and I was used to Gina.
Yeah.
I was used to people like Gina editing the book, and it was tight. The Logic of a Rose, I really like Bookmark Press, and they've been great about
stuff.
They've just really been great about it, so I don't I like to keep them where they're at.
Tell me about this new thing you're working on, this other, what is it called? I mean, Billy has been a teacher and a mover and shaker on the local writing scene for some time, and a performer, too. Dan Nelson is not the only performer here, and I'm thinking The Man with Two Arms, soon to be a major motion picture,
right,
by Dan Nelson.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
This is up your alley. I mean, it's a great book.
We'll debut at the Rhino Fest next year, and we'll take it to the film festivals after that.
I would love to get something else into the Rhino Fest, too. Is it difficult?
Well, I would tell you, I think the Rhino Fest is the best
theater
festival
that,
in the world.
Yeah.
You know, people go to Scotland as a theater festival. It is great. The people there at Prop Theater put this thing together, and they take, you know, submissions from everybody, and then they go over them. And it really is a curated festival. I joke about being in there, but I really feel so fortunate to be in there. I thank them all the time, because what they do is they say, tell us what you want to do, and if you get in, then they just take care of everything.
Wow.
And you walk in. They literally share the proceeds with the performers.
Mm.
I'm just
That's
like,
amazing.
Why are you doing
right.
this? You know,
what's wrong with you people?
It's really incredible. And if you can't afford to go to a show, they let you in for free.
Yeah.
They say you pay whatever you can. Like, literally everything about this festival is incredible.
Right.
People should go and support it. We are lucky to have the Rhino Fest in Chicago.
How many shows?
How many shows are? I think there's 45 or so.
Wow.
Yeah.
What is the ideal, like, what's a perfect scenario that could happen from something like this for a playwright?
Well, I think, you know, you get some attention, that kind of thing. But really the best thing is to, you have original work, you're going to have a built-in audience.
Right.
And you can see how people respond.
Yeah.
We got to take a little break. We'll be back. And then after 9:30, we will get on the telephone Brian Grewley, a mutual friend of ours, kind of, Billy, and we'll introduce him to Dan Nelson, because Dan is staying ever. He's hooked on radio now. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I am still here. Dan Nelson, because he loves to perform, has decided to stay for the entire show. So there are two co-hosts, or actually three now. Me, Dan Nelson, whose show, The Night the Cubs Won, will be part of Rhino Fest, RHINOFEST.com. His show will be Sunday, January 26th, Sunday, February 2nd, February 9th, and February 16th at the Prop Theater, Legendary Theater Space at 3502 North Elston Avenue. Billy Lombardo is here. What are you calling this, Billy? The reissue of How to Hold a Woman?
Yeah.
A new edition with a wonderful foreword by Gina Frangella and an incredibly handsome package from Tortoise Books. And it's too bad you're not in studio, because Brian Gurley is one of the most fun people to have in a studio because he's a great writer and a good guy, and he used to be a what we call a newspaper reporter. Brian, how are you? Brian?
At the fire in my living room.
Huh? Where are you? Sitting by a fire?
In my living room. At my living room, yeah.
Hey, Brian, it's Billy.
Billy Lombardo's
Hey, Billy,
too.
How are you, man?
Good, how are you?
And Dan, I've never met you, but welcome.
Thank you so much.
Dan, tell Brian about your show.
Oh, I have a play about, it's called The Night the Cubs Won, and it's the story of how I found out that my family were Cubs fans, and we grew up Cardinal fans, and about what I did the night that the Cubs won, which was get into a lot of trouble.
Wow.
Yeah, he lied to his wife frequently that night. Brian, congratulations. I've been, Brian, I don't know if I ever met you when you were a reporter, but I certainly met you and wear your T-shirts for your books, Bleak.
I'm still a reporter, so...
Are you still working? Are you still working for...
Yeah.
For Bleak?
Yeah, I write for Business Week magazine for your old colleague, Flynn McRoberts.
Oh, good old Tribune. Flynn. How do you...
And Bob Blau. And you know, I've been... Ever since I've known you, I've been a reporter for 40 years.
Well, that I knew. I knew. I mean, I met you...
Yeah. It feels like a million, but yeah.
How do you balance that? When you first started writing novels, which now include Bleak Harbor, Starvation Lake, The Hanging Tree, and The Skeleton Box, all of which you've been on the show to talk about, I never read your paper losses thing. How do you balance that? How do you balance the reporter's life with the fiction writer's life?
You know, I just get up early usually and write.
You're an early morning.
An hour to 2 hours in the morning, and then on weekends, wow. You know, it doesn't have to be in the morning. And, you know, one feeds off the other, sort of.
What compelled you to first do it? When did you first sit down and say, hey, you know, I have got to write a novel? What was the motivating factor for that?
Well, you know, it ego, really, because when I was a kid, I sort of wanted to be a novelist long before I thought of being a journalist. And but when, you know, when I got out of college, it was like, how are you going to be a novelist and eat? How many novels can you write about shooting pool and drinking beer? Which is basically all I knew about.
Tell me about your life.
22 years old. So, you know, I went into journalism. It was a big detour, and it wasn't until like the late 90s I had an idea, and I took a shot at this story, and I wrote about 25,000 words, and my agent at the time really thought it sucked. And but there was this little glimmer of hockey in it. I play hockey.
Yes,
and,
you do.
She said, why don't you write me a story about these middle-aged guys who play hockey in the middle of the night? And I had an idea right then, at that very moment. And that ended up being the first book, Starvation Lake. And so then The Hanging Tree, The Skeleton Box, Bleak Harbor, and the new one, Purgatory Bay. What a happy, happy name.
You should be a happy
man. I specialize in happy titles.
We got to take a break, but we're going to keep Brian Grueley on for until the 11 o'clock hour when we can all go to sleep. We got to take a short break. We'll be right back. Good to have you on, Brian.
You too.
Welcome back. We have on the phone my two new hosts of the show, Dan Nelson and Billy Lombardo, in the studio. On the phone is one of my favorite writers. He writes about bad things that go on in northern Michigan. And here, Brian, for the first time, I think in the book, or where do you write this? I think it's in the acknowledgments. You write about having gone up to northern Michigan when you were 9 years old and reading a story that is indeed wound up, the seed of one of the plot lines of this book, because it scared you, didn't it?
Yeah, there was this family. I grew up in Detroit, and I read about it in the Detroit News. I was, even then, an inveterate newspaper reader, and there was this family, the Robesons, who were in their cottage up in northern Lower Peninsula, Michigan, mm-hmm. and somebody went in and just shot them all.
Yeah,
I forget how many, but four or five, you know, mom, dad, and some kids. I don't think they were found for a month, Rick.
Ooh, wow.
And then there was an investigation, and the crime was never officially solved, but there was a suspect who ended up committing suicide. Mm. Anyway, I read about this, and a year or two after these murders, my parents bought a cottage up on a lake not too far from where these people were murdered.
And thanks, so Mom and Dad.
I would lay in bed at night wondering when
you were going to be killed.
This guy was going to show up and shoot us all. I was going to get the hell out of there. And, you know, it just sticks. If that kind of stuff sticks in your head.
Yeah.
And so it is sort of the event that sets off the string of hilarity that becomes Purgatory Bay.
Hilarity, yes.
Hey, Brian, this is Billy. What's it like going to work every day? Does it seem like there are a lot of people there who are aspiring novelists, or is it an oddity for them to have you there doing work, or what?
It doesn't seem like there are, if there are aspiring novelists there, Billy, I don't really know that. There probably are some. I work at Bloomberg here in Chicago, and probably there's 15 journalists in our office, mm-hmm. and they're all really fine journalists, reporters, and editors. And if they are aspiring novelists, they haven't told me. And I don't walk around going, "Hey, I'm a novelist." It's really not that big of a deal. I make about 1/1,000th. Of the income I make being a journalist, so it's technically, I think it's more of a hobby, even though I think of it as an avocation.
But look, for you guys, Brian and Billy, and you too, Dan, it's not all about the money, though, boys, is it?
I should better not be.
No,
you know what I mean, Brian, and you do too, Billy. It's about something else, right?
Yeah. For me, it's just a great joy of the writing itself is difficult, but it the great joy, the great possibility of saying something, of languaging the thing within. Is a ridiculous joy to me.
Yeah, I mean, to me, there you have something in you. You think of something, and you keep working on it. And just the idea of being able to get it out in a way and share it with someone else is really what it's all about. There's really no other reward that's bigger than that.
Brian, even though the paltry sums you may get for the book, it means more than just simply.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what I do. It's what I've been doing since I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And I used to make up stories about two brothers, kind of like the Hardy Boys. Remember the Hardy Boys?
Yeah.
I started making up my own version of the Hardy Boys when I was in second grade. So I've been writing either made up things or, you know, quote unquote fake news since then. It's what I do. You know, it's like eating.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Hey, Brad.
It's just something, you know, I do it all the time.
Yeah.
I just do it. And Billy's right. You know, there is sometimes there's great joy. Sometimes you're just grinding it out, you know. Sometimes you have your fastball, and sometimes you don't.
Right.
But you go out and pitch.
Yeah,
Billy. Hey, Brian, what was it like? I know that you shared a Pulitzer Prize with the folks at Wall Street Journal. What was it like, and what was your role in reporting at that time?
9/11.
So I was in the Washington Bureau of the Wall Street Journal. This was Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. And basically, long story short, my role was to write the main story about what happened that day.
Mm-hmm.
And really, most of the reporting, I mean, it came from a lot of different places, but most of it came right from New York.
Sure.
And our offices, the journal's offices at that time, were kitty corner from the towers.
Wow.
I used to stay in the Marriott in the South Tower when I visited the Journal, you know, the mothership. And so my colleagues were getting off ferries or out of cabs or out of the subway or off their bicycles and basically going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And that afternoon, we lost all phone. We couldn't reach anybody in New York for hours.
Oh.
But then we started to get emails, and there were these two waves of emails that came in. And they were coming in like click, 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 one after another.
Hmm.
And the first wave was people saying, okay, here's where I am. I'm okay. How can I help? And then the next wave were memos of things they had reported, you know. And there were, you know, I had, in the end, I had a file that was 60,000 words.
I'll bet.
I never got to most. I think I took 30,000 and made it into three. And that was one of the stories on page one. Mm. And it was an amazing day, you know, for many terrible reasons.
Sure.
But, you know, it's why you become a journalist.
Yeah, no kidding. But one of the reasons
you're there to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
You were also a... I'm just going to read a couple paragraphs from your book. These are just random paragraphs because I've...
That's all I write. Yeah.
These aren't... Yeah, the book... They're random paragraphs from a very compelling novel with a great narrative drive and a lot of suspense and thrills and dark periods.
Thank you.
She loves... And I want you two, Dan and Billy, to tell me what you think of these two. And I literally just picked these sort of at random. She loves being a cop, is proud to be a chief, but neither is enough. She needs something more, something other than the heat in her cruiser to make her warm, something other than the hall of late-night drunks to make her laugh, something more than the occasional fling to make her feel desired, someone who calls her Katya instead of chief or Malone or officer. It might help a little if the damn council would fill the damn deputy chief slot that has remained vacant at the mayor's insistence for almost a year. But Malone also knows her frustrations aren't only their fault. She's trying to think things a day at a time, but that only goes so far when each day is haunted by the same memory again and again. In those two paragraphs, I know a great, great, great deal and want to know a great deal more about the police chief of this town. What do you
guys? Excellent. Well, thank you.
Sure.
That's good.
Yeah.
Those are early in the
book.
Yeah,
very early,
right.
Beginning of chapter two.
Yeah, one of the things that I'd like to, a question that I have for you, Brian, is about craft, too, because one of the things that Rick asked earlier was what the work of being a teacher is like for a writer. And one of the things that once I learned how to write for craft and to read for craft, literature became much more important to me. And you've got something going on in that paragraph, and I always wonder if this is just something that people are getting in a zone about or that they're thinking about, but that repetition of something, 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 someone, and then it ends with this thing about this thing that you just can't shake. It happens over and over and over again. Is that deliberate right there? Is that thing always going on in your writing or what?
The short answer, Billy, is it's a great question, yes or no. But I know how that paragraph came about.
Yeah.
So this character's name is Katya Malone, and she was in Bleak Harbor. And I'm not giving away anything here.
Right.
In Bleak Harbor, she's trying to find a kidnapped boy.
Right.
And he gets away from her. And she also, she lost her own daughter, due in part to her own issues prior to that. So anyway, but that paragraph was not in the draft that I gave to my editor.
Really?
I don't think, I'm almost positive. Maybe a little bit of it was, but I don't think so. And my editor, whose name is Caitlin Alexander, she wanted more of Katya. She just asked me for more. She goes, I want her to tell me a little more about what it is she wants from what's going on here.
That's
and she just made me think about it, and it was there. So
right.
Then I guess it came out that I remember. Well, I don't remember specifically writing that paragraph, but I remember that it didn't take any work.
Right.
She just asked. She, like a really great editor, asked really great. You right. know this. Mm-hmm. All you guys know this, especially Rick. They ask great questions.
Right.
You know, you have stuff in your notebook. Is the expression in journalism. And I had that in my notebook, so to speak, in my head. And Caitlin asked the right question, and that paragraph just, boom, it just wham. It came out in, you know, a minute.
Wow, that's so interesting.
That is
that
great.
That is so interesting.
Yeah.
You get that at newspapers these days, too? You're working with some very, very good people. And as you know, the editor-reporter relationship is essential, though. In many places, it's kind of evaporating.
I'm lucky.
Yeah.
The gig I have, which is to write long, detailed narratives, there's not many jobs like this left in our profession, whether it's magazine, which I write for, or newspaper, or Wires. And so I'm lucky, and I have one editor I work with, a guy in New York named Dan Ferrara, and he asks questions like that, too.
Yeah, I think it's...
And then I say, you know, go away, Farrar.
Yeah, but that,
and then I answer
that
question.
Relationship, we were talking about it earlier with Billy, it can be a really healthy and fruitful relationship for a writer to have an editor with whom they can collaborate.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Dan, you don't collaborate.
Editors ask, you know, they ask great questions. And, you know, I always say editors perpetrate by doing what Caitlin did.
Yeah.
Tell me this. Or they liberate.
Yeah.
They go, you know what? You don't have to do that.
Yeah.
You don't have to write this boring paragraph explaining to me, you know, the history of telecommunications. Get rid of that paragraph. They liberate you from things you think you have to do.
Oh, that's well.
And that's what mostly great editors just stay the hell out of the way. But they help you along, you know.
That's well put. How do you find the contemporary publishing scene? You've been pretty lucky, I think, in that, you know, the publishing business has kind of started to implode when you started to publish. But you've done remarkably well, Brian. I mean,
I haven't quit my day job, and I'm not a millionaire. But you know, I've been lucky enough to publish some books. But you know, it's Starvation Lake, rejected 26 times, and then got a deal. And
I love stories like that.
And Bleak Harbor was also 26, depending how you count, because one editor rejected it twice. So it could have been, maybe it's just 25 editors, but it's 26 rejections before the folks at Amazon Publishing, Thomas and Mercer, picked it up.
You like this,
and who knows what happens next?
You like Thomas and Mercer, don't you? So does Sean Chirkover and our mutual friend Marcus Sakey.
Yeah. We're all friends, and you know, I mentioned Caitlin. Caitlin Alexander is one of the freelance editors they bring in to line edit your books, and she's fantastic. And the people are fun, and they really like their authors.
Yeah,
so
that's amazing.
That's great. Good for you.
You know, we're just here to and Billy and Dan and Rick. You guys all know this. You're a writer. You're kind of on a beach with you put a message in a bottle and you fling it off into the sea, and you hope somebody picks the damn thing up and reads it. And maybe they pass it to the guy in the next boat.
Yep. Right.
That's well put, Brian Grulli. I can't stop reading you, so you have to keep writing. He has a great website, too, Brian Grulli. What is it, BrianGrulli.com? You know me. I don't know.
Yeah, it's complicated. Yeah, Brian with a Y.
Brian with a Y. Brian, thanks. And I look forward to seeing you somewhere, some saloon sometime.
Take it easy, Brian.
I'll be at it. Can I give you one quick plug?
Sure. Any plug.
I'll be at a saloon Tuesday night, signing and discussing Purgatory Bay. The saloon is one of the great, my favorite bars in Chicago, Will's Northwoods Inn.
Oh, nice place.
It's a Wisconsin bar on Racine, just south of Belmont. More
south of the
Field Museum.
Just south of the Wisconsin border, yeah.
And a friend of mine runs the bar, and he wanted me to come there. And so we'll be serving Purgatory Pints and talking about the folks in that book.
That's awesome.
They're interesting folks in that book. Brian, thanks a million.
Thanks. Thank you, man, for having me. Good to talk to you,
you
and
too.
Billy
you
and
too.
Dan.
Take it
you
easy,
too.
Brian.
Take care. We'll take a little break and come back, and I have to say goodbye to the two guys who've made this show work tonight. Welcome back, everybody. It's time to say goodbye to the two guys who've kept this show running this whole time. Not Dan Long, the engineer, keeps it running. Roe Coleman, the producer, keeps it running. But I like this idea of been my first two-hour show, and as long as I can remember, Dan, usually I'm cut by Hawks games or football or something else. Dan Nelson will be performing what sounds like a fun, meaningful kind of show. It's about baseball, kinda. The night the Cubs won, it is about Dan and his wife and his mom and his grandmother and his one-time affection, his sort of genetically predisposed affection for the St. Louis Cardinals that he ruined by finding out that his grandmother was in love with the 1908 Cubs and maybe dated, I don't know, later on Hack Wilson or something. It will be the one-man show in performance Sundays beginning January 26th, then February 2nd, February 9th, and February 16th at Prop Theater, which is at 3502 North Elston. RhinoFest.com is the website, and the way Dan talks about RhinoFest, and Billy too, and me too, check out any other offerings they have. It runs for how long, Dan? I mean, for a month or two?
It's starting now. It just kicked off, and it runs basically to the end of February. Yeah. Pretty much everything there is going to be great.
Yeah, or certainly worth seeing, and modestly priced, and I mean, it's a real way to explore. You know, if you think of the old days of Chicago's storefront theater rage, it's very hard to pay whatever they're charging for Mean Girls downtown. Right. It's not downtown. We had Jay Amberg on the phone talking about his The Healer's Daughter. Billy Lombardo. Go to BillyLombardoAuthor.com. You've got a lot of events coming up, don't you, Billy?
Yep. 21st, the book is published. It comes is released. And then the 25th of this month, the
Volumes bookstore with bookstore. The aforementioned Gina Frangella, right, who should be reading from her foreword to the book because it's just wonderful. Then you're in New York for a while in February. Then you're back here at the Hungry Brain. Then you're at, Milwaukee. That's interesting. You're in Milwaukee at Linneman's River West Inn on March 3rd. Then the Harold Washington Library with two very, very nice people in conversation with Donna Seaman and Stuart Dybeck. Stuart Dybeck, the hero of us all.
Yes, absolutely.
Stuart Dybeck, the hero of us all. Tell me about this new thing, this House of Fiction deconstructed for the apprentice writer. What is that, Billy?
So I've been just all along. I've been as a creative writing teacher and as the founder and managing editor of Polyphony Lit.
Polyphony is still out there,
right?
Polyphony Lit's
still out there. It's now all on the web, and we've had kids from 71 countries who have sent us submissions. And I've got about 200 editors from about 10
different
countries.
When you say kids, Fiona and I went to one of the nice event, I think, a benefit for this maybe a year or two ago. Mm-hmm. And she just fell in love with the whole thing because she thinks she wants to, she says, what do you want to do, Fee? She's 15. And she goes, Dad, I want to be a writer. I want to write. And then she says, Dad, do you think, like, if I go to high school and I get out of college, do you think there'll still be newspapers?
Wow.
And I'm like, I don't want to tell her what I think. Frankly, I don't want to tell her what I think. But Polyphony is...
Polyphony's still thriving. And you could find it at polyphonylit.org.
I'll take a look on your website and see.
This is terrible.
No, that's okay. And how old are the kids writing for it?
They are all in high school, so it's I've got 200 editors who are from 10 different countries or so who are working on it. It's completely student run, and they're all high school kids. But one of the things that I've learned from this whole experience is how important it is for young people to write.
Yeah,
and how long it takes for some of us to learn how to write. And the House of Fiction Deconstructed is just kind of takes apart the different features of fiction and teaches them teaches students, teaches young people, teaches young writer, people who are new to writing. Really, that's the important thing. People are new to writing. A lot of the things that it's just taken me 30 years or so to
Well, but also I think, you know, living in an age where many, many, and I hate to sound like an old fart, but many, many, many kids are doing virtually most of their writing
right
in short mm-hmm. little 40 character sentences, and that will not expand. You know, it's like, especially as a kid, you have all these thoughts, and that's why I like young Chicago authors and Louder Than a Bomb,
right.
The things that allow kids to express themselves
exactly.
because they have things to say.
Yeah.
What do you think, Dan Long? End this show? Dan Long's not going to go.
That's not my call, but
go home and write a novel. Yeah, it is your call. You're the engineer. What do you think, Ro? Maybe your next show, maybe next year at Rhino Fest, Dan will have a show called Radio Show. It'll be a three-character play. You ever see Eric Bogosian's
Talk Radio? Yeah.
That is one great piece of writing. You've seen it, right?
It's great. But I think it's a five-person show.
Correct. But these two may be working. The three of us can get off and do anything. So I really want to thank Ro Coleman for getting everybody on the phone, for Dan Long engineering. We used to play music. We used to have music on the show, but those days are over with the new owners. I don't know what their deal is. Thank you all for listening. Do pick up Morning Will Come. Who decided on the title change? How did the title change come about?
Yeah, I think that
because
it was
Amy's...
Because
it does echo Never Come Morning by Nelson Algren.
I think it was Amy's idea. We ran through a couple of possibilities. One of the things about How to Hold a Woman, although I like that title and I like that story a lot, it really helped me figure out a lot of things about that. It's widely misinterpreted and
it's
a little
like
misleading.
How to Hold a Woman, the story of Harvey Weinstein and
exactly
and his troubles in Hollywood. Yeah, no,
but
you're
I
right.
do like the echo of Never Come Morning too.
Did you realize that when you picked it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jerry Brennan brought that up and he said, "I don't know if that's bad or that's good."
I think it's good.
Well, I like it.
I think it's good. And again,
Anne Weinstock, by the way, did the cover. It's really
amazing.
What do
you think, Dan Long? It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ro Coleman thinks, yes, beautiful. Can't hear you. All right. So much for Radio 2020.
Yeah. Rick, thanks a lot.
Have a good week. Next week I'm having on, it's just an hour-long show. And I'm going to have on a fellow named John Sauce, about whom I wrote about in the Chicago Tribune today, if you still pick up and like to read newspapers. So that's the end of this show. Thanks. See you next week.